Undisclosed, The Killing of Freddie Gray, Episode 13, is brought to you by Blue Apron, Bowl and Branch, and ThreadUp. Make sure you listen in for those spots later in the show and support our sponsors because they support us. Also, a reminder to listeners that the research, analysis, and opinions of the investigators, journalists, academics, and lawyers who you'll hear on this program about the circumstances surrounding Freddie Gray's killing are just that. Research, analysis, and opinions. We encourage listeners to reach their own conclusions and to vigorously debate our conclusions with us. Enjoy the program.
It's said that all truths are easy to understand once they are discovered. The point is to discover them. So you'd think in an incident that caught national attention and scrutiny with dozens of eyewitnesses and video footage and evidence, discovering the truth about what killed Freddie Gray would be the least complicated issue. But what happens when that discovery is muddled, when fog is created by implicated parties and others to make us second guess what our eyes saw? Whose job is it to clear that fog up and to get to the bottom of who did what, of what the truth really is? Some would argue, and I would too, in an incident involving the death of a citizen, when the parties involved can't fully be trusted to tell us what really happened, that job falls to the press. Now, we know an entire industry of fake news exists online to sow confusion and mistrust, but there are traditional media establishments we all trust to investigate and report the facts. That's right, we trust them, even when maybe we shouldn't. And that's why Malcolm X called the media the most powerful entity on earth, because they have the power to make the innocent look guilty and the guilty to look innocent. Hi and welcome to Undisclosed, The Killing of Freddie Gray. My name is Rabia Chaudhry. I'm here with my colleagues, Dr. Marcia Chatlin, Justine Barron, and Amelia McDonald Perry.
My name is Amelia McDonald Perry, and I'm a former blog editor and a journalist for RollingStone.com and CrimeFeed.
I'm Marcia Chatlin. I'm an associate professor of history and African American studies at Georgetown University, and I'm also an Eric and Wendy Schmidt Fellow at the New America Foundation.
My name is Justine Barron. I'm a screenwriter, researcher, and columnist at the Jewish Journal.
While reading stories about the possible connections between Donald Trump's associates and Russia, and seeing how much of it has been based on anonymously sourced leaks from White House insiders to media, I've often thought, not since Freddie Gray. For 2 years, the stories surrounding Freddie Gray's death have been shaped by media leaks from individuals within the Baltimore Police Department, as well as by other police PR strategies, usually with far less corroborating support or finesse than the current White House leaks seem to have. If you type, "How did Freddie Gray die?" into your internet search bar, you are likely to see stories that have since been discredited, as well as others for which there is still no proof. The story of Freddie Gray's death and its aftermath is deeply intertwined with how it was told by media. It's not just that the news reflected what happened, but that the entire case cannot be separated from how the Baltimore Police Department and some of its members sought to manage it publicly. The early weeks of media coverage into Freddie Gray's death has distinct chapters, marking rapidly shifting trends in the coverage. During week one, as Gray lay in a coma in the hospital, local TV news reports focused on cell phone video and eyewitness accounts to his arrest.
Gray! His leg looks broke! Look at his leg! His leg!
When Freddie Gray died, during week two, national news outlets pounced on Baltimore, focusing on the accounts of witnesses and people close to Freddie Gray.
Freddie Gray bent up into what I would like to call a pretzel type of move, where they had the heels of his feet to his back, and then he was still in handcuffs, and then they had the knee like in the back of his neck.
Throughout these 2 weeks, Baltimore police held press conferences and gave statements, during which they would reveal bits of information about what happened to Freddie Gray. While the police story evolved, a couple of messages stayed consistent from day one. First, that there was a need for ongoing investigation, And second,
and as we have stated before, that we had no evidence, physical or video or statements of any use of force.
Then, while the protests gained more steam in the eyes of the country war on Baltimore, the leadership settled on another, more solid message.
It's clear that what happened happened inside the van. And we don't have any procedure that would have an officer riding in the back of the van with the suspects. So even if the officers had body cameras, it would not cover that period of time.
The mayor made this statement on April 20th, before the autopsy was complete and before the task force had even begun its investigation into Gray's death. She said this one day after Freddie Gray died and not one day before. Nothing else had changed, except that the person in police custody, who knew best what happened, was no longer around to tell his story. It was a refrain that would be repeated publicly by many others in the coming days from within the Baltimore Police Force and the Fraternal Order of Police. Whatever happened, happened in the van. Even though none of them ever said that what happened in the van to Freddie Gray was purposeful, their statements inspired a new theme in the media speculation into Gray's death.
If Gray wasn't struck by officers, then the likely explanation for his severed spine, a fall against the van's metal interior, possibly caused by a rough ride.
The rough ride story dominated Freddie Gray-related news until April 27th, when police and civilians met in a violent confrontation in West Baltimore, known as the riots. From here, the story takes a darker turn, if you can believe it. Strange, improbable, and dark theories about Gray's death emerge daily, frantically it seems, and get national attention. This, while the city was under curfew and residents could no longer organize and resist. Most of these stories were anonymously sourced, but carried the allure of credibility. They came from actual police sources, it seemed, and actual police documents. Around April 27th, a right-wing news website called the Fourth Estate, which no longer exists, printed a story that Freddie Gray had a pre-existing back injury. Exclusive, it said, Freddie Gray's life-ending injuries to his spine may have possibly been the result of spinal and neck surgery that he allegedly received a week before he was arrested, not from rough treatment or abuse from police. This story spread on social media and conservative sites and grew details, like that Freddie had had multiple spinal fusion surgeries. The Fourth Estate based its findings on a civil court record in Gray's case search files from Howard County, showing settlement payments from Allstate Insurance. The Baltimore Sun published an article on the 29th debunking this story. The settlement was related to a 2008 lawsuit awarded to Gray and his twin sister as a result of childhood toxic lead paint poisoning. The Fourth Estate article also stated this. Other anonymous sources indicate that Gray may have had surgery as recently as 10 days prior to the incident in which he was involved in a 45-minute flee to evade the authorities. So it's easy to assume that the Fourth Estate made the story up, that there were no such anonymous sources. Keep listening. A version of this story showed up in the trial of Officer William Porter. Among mainstream outlets, the debunking of the loony right-wing pre-existing injury story became the story. On April 30th, the Washington Post published a story titled, "Those stories that Freddie Gray had a pre-existing spinal injury are totally bogus." It began, "It's still not clear what happened to Freddie Gray. Was he hurt during his arrest? Was he attacked by police in the back of that Baltimore police van? Or did he try to injure himself, as documents obtained Tuesday by the Washington Post suggest?" Yeah, so about those documents. Just one day before the Washington Post treated that pre-existing back injury story like totally bogus garbage, it published its own exclusive story, suggesting that Freddie Gray caused his own injury. "Prisoner in van heard banging against walls" was the headline. The writer, Peter Herman, stated that the other prisoner in the van believed Gray was intentionally trying to injure himself. This was the Dante Allen story. Herman said that he got this information from a search and seizure warrant application provided by an anonymous source. Herman described the other passenger as a 38-year-old man accused of violating a protective order, though he didn't mention how he knew that. This story was pretty vague. It went viral anyway. Baltimore's Jane Miller from WBAL News discredited the story just after it was posted. She was interviewed on MSNBC.
This is no problem with my buddy Peter Herman at the Washington Post who wrote this story. There is a search warrant that contains that information that's written by a Baltimore City police officer. This story has been around from the beginning of this incident, and that is that Freddie Gray injured himself. We have reported for some time since this happened that according to our sources, by the time that prisoner is loaded into that van, Freddie Gray was unresponsive. Secondly, we have reported that there is no evidence, medical evidence, that Freddie Gray suffered any injury that would indicate that he injured himself by banging his head against the van wall, door, whatever you want to say.
This wasn't the first time Miller provided a counter-narrative to stories coming out of BPD about Freddie Gray. Her reporting team revealed a call for a medic to stop Five for an injured arm before police say Gray was injured. She looked closely at the CCTV video of Stop Five, of all of the cops with the door wide open staring at Freddie Gray. Within one day of Peter Herman's article in the Washington Post, Dante Allen came forward and claimed that he was riding in the van with Freddie Gray. But he wasn't this guy in the story. He was 22. He had been picked up for a drug charge, not a protective order violation. And he was never arrested. Allen also claimed that he never said exactly that Gray was trying to injure himself. Well, he did. But he was apparently coached, and that's a long story about witness tampering and intimidation. Allen gave his first interview to WJZ News, but his later interview with Jane Miller aired first and went viral. It gave fuel to the theory that Miller had unique access because of her relationship with Janice Bledsoe, the lead prosecutor on the case and her now wife. Miller's access became a source of discontent from many corners. The Fraternal Order of Police, several conservative websites, and the Baltimore Sun, who said her relationship presented a conflict of interest. Miller recused herself from reporting on the story after the charges were announced. This left very few counter-narratives that were closely examining the evidence in this case. That said, Miller's reporting never really did stray too far from the case her wife presented in court, in which Gray was unconscious by Stop 5.
It is now time for me to read what is by far my favorite ad spot. That's right, I get to talk about Blue Apron. Why is it my favorite ad spot, you ask? Well, that's because not only do I get to talk about how delicious Blue Apron is, how wonderful it is to cook with Blue Apron, but I also get to talk smack about the other undisclosed hosts who are cooking with Blue Apron. I'm looking specifically at Dr. Marcia Shetland and Amelia McDonald Perry. I've seen you two put the pics on the Twitters of the meals that you cooked with Blue Apron, and while they look good, what I'm trying to tell you is that I've been down on this Blue Apron game since they started sponsoring Undisclosed about a year ago, and I bring an experience to the table that y'all just don't have yet. Be patient, it'll come, but for now, step your game up. Let me tell you how you can do it with this week's menu. Check it out. You're going to have warm smoked trout, asparagus salad with fingerling potatoes and garlic croutons, elote style vegetable tostadas with summer squash, poblano peppers and cilantro rice, and some delicious peach honey glazed chicken with mashed sweet potatoes, collard greens, and Thai basil. Oh, it's so good. It's gonna feel good in my belly. It's gonna be even better when I put these pics on Twitter and shame you into admitting that my Blue Apron cooking style is just stronger than yours. Okay, so seriously, Blue Apron knows that when you cook with incredible ingredients, you're gonna make higher quality meals. So check out this week's menu and get your first three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/undisclosed. You're gonna love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. So don't wait, that's blueapron.com/undisclosed. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
Interestingly, the Dante Allen story actually had its origins in the social media rantings of a disgruntled cop. On April 26th, a website called Photography is Not a Crime, or PINAC, published a story about a cop on Facebook named Avraham or Avi Tasher. He posted this comment: Freddie broke his own neck. Don't believe the media lies. Police never harmed him or denied him medical attention. He was faking injury to get attention, then snapped his own spinal cord by smashing his head into the wall repeatedly. Even the other prisoner gave a statement to that effect. Peter Herman credited this story and thanked Pinnock for their lead. Tascher may have been Herman's source, although he wasn't a part of the investigation. He worked in a plainclothes jumper squad. He might have connected Herman to friends of his in homicide, or maybe Herman reached out to BPD for confirmation. As Jane Miller noted, the story about Gray injuring himself had been around since the beginning. Even as the idea that Gray severed his own spine was still making news on April 30th, another theory emerged as fact. Brad Bell from WGLA in Washington, D.C., had this scoop.
Knew that Freddie Gray was okay when he got in the van and wasn't when he got out. Now we know a little bit more from our law enforcement sources as to why they believe that to be the case. According to our law enforcement sources, an autopsy found on Freddie Gray's head a mark on the top of his head that matched a place on the back of the police transport van, specifically a bolt. Now, they described Freddie Gray as having handcuffs behind his back and legs in shackles. And the theory is that he was in the back of the van, very low headroom, standing over like this, and for some reason went flying in the van, and that is what caused his injuries.
We call this one the bolt story. As this story went viral, headlines included, Freddie Gray died after head slammed into bolt in police van. And medical examiner, Gray slammed into back of police transport van, breaking his neck. The medical examiner's office denied this report and stated that they don't issue preliminary findings. Then there was this headline, Freddie Gray sustained injuries in the back of the van, which kind of overlaps with the Dante Allen story. It's as if the old story about Gray hurting himself crossfaded into the new one about the bolt. And then the old one, it's like it never existed. The bolt story came out within an hour of Dante Allen appearing on TV denying what the Washington Post reported about him. 1 hour. Meanwhile, the Washington Post's story on the bolt theory makes zero mention of Dante Allen. I remind you, that story was one day before. It's as if the media collectively said, oh, this story makes more sense. He slammed his head. This one comes from a doctor. Well, it comes from a source who knows a source who talked to the doctor. A little context for what else was happening on April 30th, besides all this madness. For the last 11 days, Commissioner Anthony Batts had assembled a task force of 30 officers working on the case. He held a press conference that very day, announcing that the investigation was to be concluded a day early. His deputy commissioner, Kevin Davis, announced the task force's results. One previously unreleased stop, stop three, at which Goodson allegedly checked on Gray. That's the official task force results. Then, just hours earlier, we have this bolt story. The WGLA reporter sure made it sound like the bolt story was the big result of the investigation and autopsy. Two separate investigation results, one official and one leaked. It's almost as if BPD scooped itself, or as if someone inside of BPD wanted to give the public a better, more conclusive story without getting into trouble. The bolt story came, conquered, and disappeared in a day. It was not a part of the defense's case at all. But in the survival of the fittest in this bizarre week of leaks, it is the victor. It lives on in SEO results as the police findings. Nobody ever publicly debunked it. The true story about the bolt was told in court and barely touched by media. Dr. Carol Allen, the medical examiner, did discover an abrasion on Freddie Gray's right temple in her examination. On April 28th, she inspected the van, joined by several members of the task force. She noticed the bolt and concluded that it was not responsible for that abrasion. Then, 2 days later, the story was leaked, suggesting that she said that it was responsible not only for the abrasion, but for Gray's death. This is Bizarro World. Journey back in time with me, please. 3 weeks earlier, the main story about Freddie Gray was the civilians who witnessed excessive force. It seems so long ago. It was a more innocent time then, when the police manipulated the public directly through direct statements, and the public organized and protested in resistance. We've crossed into a different era of media manipulation here, with shadowy sources making an incomprehensible mess of the truth, possibly on purpose. The theories and leaks heated up during the last week of April. Then the charges were announced and BPD boiled over.
He was observed in a hand-to-hand transaction, small items in exchange for currency, at which time they approached Mr. Gray and the other individual, at which time they both fled. A foot pursuit was called out. Mr. Gray was stopped in the 1700 block of Pressbury. The other suspect, I believe, was stopped in the 1700 block of Fulton, I believe.
This is a barely disguised police officer interviewed by Fox News' Sean Hannity about the charges. First, can I say that is a terrible voice disguiser, right? I could plainly hear a man with a high-pitched, thick Baltimore accent. And then it sounds like some monster is whispering behind him. Anyway, this officer leaked a bit more from the inside.
The preliminary toxicology report was done at the University of Maryland. Shock trauma. Mr. Gray's urine was tested and found positive for heroin and marijuana.
Whoa. So this has not been made public before. And you're saying that the toxicology report, a preliminary report, has come back and his urine tested positive for heroin and marijuana?
Correct.
I know that he has an arrest record for being a drug dealer or known heroin dealer. Was he known to be a user of the drug?
If you were to go on averages, when people flee in Baltimore during a drug transaction, they do two things. The first thing they do would be possibly try to throw it, in their flight. The second choice would be to ingest it. And 9 times out of 10, they'll stick the drugs right in their mouth, chomp them up, take a bottle of water, swallow them, and they're never recovered.
Okay. So
Gray's toxicology report was positive for opioids and cannabinoids. The autopsy hadn't been made public. Only a few people were said to have seen it. Like many of the leaks so far, this takes some bit of tangential truth and then perverts it. Fox interviewed one more anonymous cop that day on Megyn Kelly's show.
Tonight in a Kelly File exclusive, a Baltimore cop tells us the officer's side of this story. He asked us to call him Mike, and we agreed for his safety to disguise his identity. Mike, thank you very much for being here. And so you know all 6 of the officers involved in this case. How do you know them?
I actually work with all of them.
How many of them have you spoken with since the incident with Freddie Gray?
I've spoken with 2 of them for actually a pretty lengthy conversation.
And they relayed to you their take on what happened with Freddie Gray in that van?
They did.
Come on, Mike sounds like a woman. They even show her with long hair. Anyway, Mike introduced another theory about Freddie Gray that would continue to have legs.
Just said something straight about Freddie himself. I mean, going back to the snitches get stitches things, Freddie was one of those ones where a lot of times he would put on that show on the streets, but you'd bring him in the station, and he was a great witness. I mean, he helped the department solve many crimes and type of different acts of violence, so it wasn't uncommon for Freddie to do that type of thing and then go into the station.
On this very same day, May 1st, the day of the charges, a Sergeant John Herzog of the Western District Detective Unit wrote a memo to various officials having a recollection about Freddie Gray. Gray had come in on March 31st to share information with him and his colleague about crime in the community. That is, Freddie Gray was a snitch. We've asked around, from Gray's closest family friends to people who knew him from around the area, and not one would accept that Freddie Gray was a snitch. They were certain otherwise. As our own Dee Watkins, who knew Freddie Gray casually, said, "Do you think all those people would be protesting out in the streets over a snitch?" Sergeant Herzog's memo had more. He recalled that Gray was sitting awkwardly in the chair, leaning to the left. Herzog asked why, and Gray told him, because Freddie was friendly with the police like that, right? Never mind all of those arrests. Gray explained that he had a bad back, or had hurt his back, according to Herzog. Herzog said that hearing rumors that Gray might have had a car accident jogged his memory. In a later interview, Herzog explained how he ended up talking to Gray that day. He said he saw him on the corner of Penn and North. Gray then took off running, and Herzog caught up with him. So you know, exactly like the famous story of how Gray got arrested. Okay, Herzog. This memo was an issue during Officer Porter's trial. Judge Williams ruled that the prosecution's failure to turn it over to the defense was a discovery violation. Never mind its questionable origins. Once the charges were announced, BPD investigators started discovering all sorts of helpful information about Gray, like that he had faked an injury in the jails, a story provided by an anonymous jail source. The prosecution's failure to investigate or turn over these leads to the defense were sanctioned. The motions filed by the defense about these discovery violations managed to get these stories into the media. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is how the bad back story ended up back in the news, this time wrapped in layers of police and court credibility. Never forget, it was debunked.
So here's the deal. I've got a 3-month-old baby and I don't get a lot of sleep nowadays. So like many of you who can't afford to sleep in, well, we have to make our sleep count. And in order to do so, you need Bowl and Branch sheets. You will be so comfortable that you'll fall asleep faster, sleep deeper, and wake up ready to kick some ass. These sheets have been amazing. What makes them unique is each sheet is crafted from 100% organic cotton. That means Bowl and Branch sheets not only feel incredible, but they also look amazing. And because they sell exclusively online, you don't pay that expensive retail markup. That is half the price for twice the quality. You will love these sheets. You can try them for 30 nights and see for yourself. And if you're not impressed, return them for a full refund. Anyone who sleeps on Bowl and Branch sheets loves them. That's why they have thousands of 5-star reviews. So go to bowlandbranch.com today and you'll get $50 off your first set of sheets plus free shipping anywhere in the U.S. when you use the promo code undisclosed. That's $50 off plus free U.S. shipping right now at bowlandbranch.com. Just to make sure you get it right, bowlandbranch.com is B-O-L-L and the word and branch.com. Don't forget to use our promo code undisclosed and get $50 off and free shipping. Bowlandbranch.com, promo code undisclosed, and enjoy the world's softest bedding.
When the defense team took over the case against the officers, police did leak fewer stories directly to media. Instead, they let pretrial motions do their dirty work, attaching documents, like the bad back memo, to motions. The Baltimore Sun's Justin Fenton did a lot of reporting on pretrial motions, but almost always just motions filed by the defense. Not motions filed by the state's attorney's office, or not their responses to defense motions. I'm going to guess that Fenton wasn't reading all of the motions, just the ones that he was handed. Then, on June 24th, someone did leak the full narrative portion of the autopsy to Fenton. Mosby's office had just filed a motion the week before requesting a protective order to limit the release of the autopsy and other information. She got heat from the Sun, who quoted a source saying that Mosby had something to hide in the autopsy. Although the autopsy concluded that Gray's death was a homicide, which benefited the prosecutors, the rest of the narrative looked good for those who wanted to protect the cops from blame. Articles about the autopsy talked about the injury happening during the van ride, and exposed that Gray had drugs in his bloodstream. So about these leaks, where did they come from? It seems unlikely that all of these media leaks of a similar nature during the same key time frames would come from just different random disgruntled cops. A lot of the information that was being leaked should have only been known to the investigators and commanders. Homicide Chief Stanley Branford oversaw the task force investigation. The lead detective was initially Sarita Teal from the force investigation team, but Homicide Detective Danielle Taylor was assigned to help Teal with legal issues and warrant applications, like writing the application that included Dante Allen's statements. Then Taylor took over the investigation and drafted all of them herself. The task force supposedly included 30 members, but the core was really just a few members from Homicide under Branford. We know from the trials and motions that Branford and Taylor were openly hostile to the prosecution and were helping the defense. They created materials, like that knife demonstration that Taylor made, that attempted to disprove the state's case. Marilyn Mosby referred to this as a counter-investigation when the trials ended. So were Branford and Taylor also behind the leaks? Our team recently received hundreds of pages of investigative materials in two binders from a Public Information Act request. The binders show a lot of activity for a couple of weeks, and then, in the last week of April, very little. There's an odd section of the binder called Facebook, which includes articles and social media, most of it pulled during that last week. This includes the Fourth Estate article about Gray's bad back, and PINAC's first story about Avi Tasher, that cop who posted on Facebook about the other van rider. It also includes Avi Tasher's police data pulled on April 27th, 2 days before the leak to the Washington Post. It's also important to look at where these stories were leaked. Typically, BPD information gets sent or leaked to the Baltimore Sun or one of the local TV stations. But the Dante Allen and Bolt stories were sent out of town to the Washington Post and a local TV station in D.C. I asked a number of reporters, including Justin Fenton and Jane Miller, if this was common, and they all said no, not at all. Most other towns don't even care about Baltimore. I was reminded that Kevin Davis, then deputy commissioner, and now the Baltimore police commissioner, had spent his career in the D.C. area as the assistant chief of Prince George's County. I checked online. Davis was a media-savvy leader. He was quoted in countless articles by The Post and WJLA during his years there. Peter Herman from The Washington Post was also a Baltimore Sun crime reporter in the 2000s. Either way, the campaign to discredit Marilyn Mosby's charges before they were even announced seems to have been an inside job. One day after the charges, the Baltimore Sun came out with an exclusive story about the inner workings of the task force. The investigators were described as diligent and dedicated to the truth. We cannot overlook Commissioner Anthony Batts's role in the bizarre media circus around Freddie Gray. Batts, he had his own special relationship with the press. On April 21st, the Baltimore Sun published a story by Justin Fenton titled, "Baltimore Police Internal Memo Says Batts Met with Officers in Freddie Gray Probe." It directly quotes an email from Batts sent to all BPD staff after he spoke with the officers under investigation. The email said, quote, "I assured them, and now I want to assure you, we will follow the facts wherever they take us. The facts, not emotion, will determine the outcome in this case. Have pride in yourself, each other, and the organization as you work to keep the city of Baltimore safe." That's the breaking news. A nice-sounding email, not attributed to any source. 5 days later, on April 26th, another similar article appeared, this by Fenton's colleague Kevin Rector. It features another internal email to staff by Anthony Batts, praising them for their handling of the first violent night of protests. That's a whole article, one email. It shouldn't be so hard to figure out who leaked these stories, if you can call them stories. If you notice, neither of these articles contains any quotes from any actual police officers who received the emails. Batts' relationship with the rank-and-file police officers had been tense since he arrived in Baltimore. His relationship with the public never gelled, and he began using the media to try to control the narrative early on, but he wasn't consistent or strategic in his messaging. Batts' loose, clumsy lips got him into trouble often. On the day that Freddie Gray died, he expressed his condolences to the family and then said, "All lives matter." The Baltimore Sun had an interesting interpretation of this. They called it a nod to the Black Lives Matter mantra. Okay. After the trials, Marilyn Mosby said, "Batts was having these press conferences every day and disclosing information that shouldn't have been disclosed. He told me he would not go on to give any information without passing it through me, and 45 minutes later, he was having another press conference." So much of how the case played out before media was by Batts' design. The release of information just after Gray's death, those CCTV videos posted on YouTube, then taken down and put back up, all chopped up. The setting up of a task force and giving them only 11 days to figure out a case, that is not how policing works, ever. And all of it was met with a lot of criticism. Batts' issues and habits came crashing down on the day of Freddie Gray's funeral. He and his media spokesman issued a joint statement that there was a credible threat that gangs were going to get together and attack police. Right. Everyone, journalists, politicians, the FBI, discredited this, wondering why it came from his media department and not his intelligence department. Batts' spokesman was forced out, but Anthony Batts continued to invent stories to try to save his job. He blamed the increase in crime after the riots on drugs from the looted CVS flooding the market, another disproven story. If there is a light and a dark to Anthony Batts' leadership, the light seems to be a bottomless need to be liked and respected, and the dark appears to be a belief in his own invincibility, that he could control the media narrative. The even darker seems to be an inability to process that a young man had died and people were grieving without turning the story into something very gruesome and self-serving.
I can think of a million reasons why thrifting is the best, but instead I'll give you three. One, it's better for the planet, which I don't know if you've heard is kind of in a bit of trouble right now. Due to the rise of fast fashion, textile waste has risen from 7% to 30% in just the past 5 years. Buying secondhand creates less trash. Two, shopping secondhand saves money. That's rad. Who doesn't love to save money? And three, thrifting is really fun. I never know what I'm going to find when I'm raiding the t-shirt rack at the flea market or hitting up my neighborhood Saturday stoop sales or checking out the latest fashions at ThredUp. ThredUp is the world's largest online thrift store, so I can resell shop from the comfort of my gently used, recently thrifted couch. Thrifting is a 24/7 lifestyle as far as I'm concerned. Anyway, here's the deal. ThredUp adds over 15,000 items to their site every day, which gives you thousands of ways to give your wardrobe the style update it deserves. Search by your favorite brands. They've got J.Crew, Gap, Anthropologie. You know that stuff is so expensive sometimes. And you can filter by size, color, price, and style to easily find what you're looking for. Every item is triple checked by hand, ensuring only the highest quality styles. When you place your order, all your like-new treasures will arrive neatly folded and packaged in ThredUp's signature polka dot box. ThredUp offers free shipping on qualified orders and easy returns. Head on over to ThredUp.com today to save up to 90% off retail on your favorite brands. Plus, right now, go to ThredUp.com/undisclosed to get an extra 40% off your first order. ThredUp.com, and that's spelled ThredUp.com/undisclosed. That's an extra 40% off right now at ThredUp.com/undisclosed. Be right back. That's like a really good deal. The media outside of Baltimore largely depended on local reporters from the Baltimore Sun, city paper, local TV news outlets, and the nearby Washington Post for the details in their own coverage of Freddie Gray's injury and eventual death. Sure, a number of major national news outlets certainly sent their own reporters to the city, but Freddie Gray wasn't their priority. What finally brought the national media, and specifically the TV networks, to Baltimore, making the city headline news, wasn't the unexplained death of a 25-year-old black man, but a burning CVS. We'll be talking about the uprising and riots extensively in our next episode, but let's just say that the media, particularly executives at Fox News, MSNBC, and CNN, will drop literally everything to show live footage of a burning building. Up until Freddie died and before the tensions in the city had gone from a simmer to a boil, the major networks were covering the story, but relying on the police press conferences, local media, and the occasional guest via Skype. One exception was CNN's Miguel Marquez, who was among the first national correspondents on the scene. Unlike many of his colleagues, Marquez divided his time between covering the protests and talking to witnesses at Gilmore Homes.
It's the sort of story that, you know, you could be there for an hour, you could be there for a day, and it turned out we were there for, I don't know, a month, something like that, whatever it was.
Yeah. So you guys were among some of the first to really interview some of the neighborhood people. Like, for example, I know that you interviewed Kevin Moore. Can you tell me about what that experience was like?
Kevin was a very hard guy to track down. Everybody wanted to talk to Kevin Moore. And what was funny about Kevin and what's funny about that, about Sandtown and that neighborhood is that everybody knows everybody. And the people that I wanted to speak were right in the neighborhood, and I had seen them almost every day, but I knew the names, I didn't know the faces, so I didn't know who any of them. We were hiding in plain sight, basically. We finally got to meet Kevin. It took a lot of chat and talk, and we got to be, you know, earn his trust, basically. And then he was able to sort of open up with us about what he saw that day. There were other Brandon Ross, who was also on the day that Freddie Gray was arrested. He spoke with us. I know he's had a tough time since then, but I when I go to Baltimore, I go to that neighborhood and see if they're around, because you know they were reluctant to talk to me, to CNN, to trust anybody from outside, and I really appreciated that they at some point opened curtains on their life and let us in.
Marquez was the first journalist to obtain the video from Stop 2, shot by Brandon Ross, showing an unmoving Freddie hanging halfway outside the van. Marquez says he got the video from an unnamed third party, who received it either from Brandon or the owner of the phone, a woman named Michelle Gross. On April 23rd, Marquez focused one of his CNN segments on the video and even interviewed Jacqueline Jackson, who gave him the same account she gave our podcast.
New video shows Freddie Gray minutes after his initial arrest, the last time he was seen publicly and alive. The video is short, but it shows Gray not moving, lying half in, half out of the police van.
He wasn't responding. His head was down, his feet was like this. And they picked him up and threw him up in the paddy wagon.
This is the corner of Baker and Mount Street. This is a block from where Freddie Gray was arrested. He was arrested just around the corner down at the end of this block. This is where police pulled him out of the van, they say, to shackle his feet. There was a woman watching everything right across the street.
He looked unconscious to you?
Yes. Yes, and I asked them, could they get him a paramedic? They told me to mind my business. I said, it is my business.
Well, the Stop 2 video popped up in a few more CNN segments and on the local Baltimore CBS affiliate. It didn't get nearly as much airplay as Kevin Moore's video from Stop 1. Quote, I think there was so much reporting at the time that it was just one more piece of information, Marquez said. CNN also didn't make use of the video's audio, in which Brandon can be heard shouting. But still, as Marquez noted in his own report, this video was the last time Freddie Gray was seen alive, and he was not moving. It's hard to understand how a major network like CNN could broadcast this footage without it catching the attention of local outlets like WBAL and the Baltimore Sun. Or maybe it did, but neither outlet wanted to give attention to a competitor for a story they wanted to dominate. A month later, on May 20th, the Baltimore Sun's Catherine Rentz wrote her own story about the mystery surrounding Stop 2. She interviewed Michelle Gross and debuted the Sun's version of Brandon's video, which involved filming it with a cell phone camera. Very popular in Baltimore, apparently. While the Sun didn't claim exclusivity, they also made no reference to the footage actually being out there already. Their story was picked up by other media, and nearly all specifically refer to the Stop 2 footage as new and credit the Sun with its release. The Washington Post's Wesley Lowery also went to Baltimore to report on Gray's death, as well as the unrest. He pointed out that one of the primary difficulties in reporting about a crime is the monopoly the police have on key information and the power they hold with how and when it's disclosed.
And that's a problem everywhere in all of these cases, right? Is that you end up having the police reporters who are covering these stories, and they end up becoming mouthpieces very often through the information they're receiving for the police version of the story, right? And very often there's an inclination among the media to value very heavily and weight very heavily information we're receiving from the police, and to devalue information we're receiving from independent witnesses or other people, right? As you start to see a skewing in the coverage that values and weights the police version of the story much more so than the version presented by someone else. And that then becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy now, because now that police version of the story has been indoctrinated and disseminated by the media, right? So it's no longer just the police saying this thing, but the Baltimore Sun says this is what happened, the Washington Post says this is what happened. And that starts to codify the narrative of what happened, and again, begins laying the groundwork for either officers not to be charged or officers that cannot be convicted.
Vetting this information, or at least regarding it with a degree of doubt, is the media's responsibility. National outlets that didn't have the resources to send a reporter to Baltimore for a month, as CNN did, were thus left to count on local journalists to do their due diligence for them. Here's Jane Miller, who's been an investigative reporter in Baltimore for over 30 years.
Police departments are like every other organization. What they tell you is in their best interest. So when they release information to the public, it is generally what they're telling you and what they're revealing is in their best interest, whether that's a police department or a political office or a private company. I mean, that's natural, and it's particularly so because some of the matters in policing become very controversial. And
right.
We've certainly seen that around the country when that first kind of story or two that comes out about a controversial incident is not exactly the whole story. There's a great deal of power that is centered in police departments. And the other thing that has happened over a long period of time is that there's this kind of natural relationship that grows between reporters and police.
Right.
So they're all kind of on the same page.
And, like, I get it. I mean, who doesn't want sources who can give you the information, like, give you the scoop? Like, I get it. At the same time, I've always felt like, you know, obviously report what the police are saying, but I also sort of feel like you should, like any other source, you have to
exactly
look at it critically and vet the information as best as possible.
Absolutely, and you got to smell it out. That's what I always say, is like, smell it out. It's like, does this sound right? Does this smell right? A reporter should be the natural watchdog. A reporter should be the natural adversary of just about everybody.
As Lowry notes, the media has a long history towards valuing information provided by the police over what can be gathered from civilian witnesses. There's also a bigger story to tell about the historical and cultural context in which Freddie was even arrested, not to mention the fury of his community after his death. I spoke with Jamila King, who wrote about Freddie's death, the uprising, and the police officers' trials for Take Part and Mike.com.
I mean, I think that, you know, from the beginning, this case was, the narrative of this case was built before Freddie Gray even made eye contact with the officer that morning in Baltimore. I think that, but before then, you know, we'd seen so many either cell phone videos or still photos taken with cameras around the time that he was killed, leading up to when he was killed, of black men and black men's bodies specifically being brutalized and being, you know, arrested. And so I think that even the images that we saw specific to Freddie Gray, that narrative was sort of built in with everything else that we'd seen before that, right? That was Oscar Grant. That was, to an extent, Trayvon Martin. That was Tamir Rice eventually. And so I think because this happened when it did, because this happened so shortly after Ferguson, because this happened so publicly in a place like Baltimore, which has this long history of police violence and brutality in black communities, you know, when people saw those videos, they were immediately able to sort of fill in the blanks, right? It didn't necessarily matter what happened exactly, but we know that he didn't survive that car ride. And I think that's what people walked away from, and that's all they need to hear, frankly.
The facts matter, but they don't guarantee a just outcome, and they offer little comfort to the bereaved. Before Freddie was killed, Baltimore had already felt the loss of Tyrone West, Anthony Anderson, Tyree Woodson, and so many more. The facts surrounding their deaths were parsed too, and then dismissed and left behind. The mainstream media is predominantly white, mostly male, and largely ill-equipped, not to mention largely disinterested in dealing with this reality.
Like in many U.S. cities, Baltimore's newspaper landscape has shrunk since the days when newspapers printed morning and evening editions, and television had yet to be invented. Baltimore's first newspapers were founded in the late 18th century, and in those days, newspapers advertised their political affiliations and made clear where they stood on the issues of the day. Republican, Democrat, Whig, anti-slavery, suffrage, you name it. The idea and expectation of objectivity in journalism was introduced later in the 20th century, but throughout these eras in journalism, the issue of representation or the lack of representation of African American voices permeated across papers, then radio, and television and online journalism. The Black newspaper movement, started by the New York-based Freedom's Journal in 1827, organized to create more well-rounded stories about Black life and culture, raise awareness about injustice from slavery to Jim Crow to the Great Migration to contemporary struggles against racism, and was the only place where Black journalists and editors could actually work in media in substantive ways before the 1960s. Since its founding in 1892, Baltimore's Afro-American continues to tell the stories of Black Baltimore, with an eye to communities that are often out of the national spotlight. In 1893, they made this clear to readers, in response to a letter to the editor. The Afro-American declared, "As to general news, we think we have done very well in that direction. If we have seemed to be biased in matters of interest to the colored man, it has been because editors of the white press have as a rule only reflected our sins and hid our virtues." While the Baltimore Afro-American was covering Black Baltimore, major papers like the Baltimore Sun were often outside observers of Black communities. From the first time it was printed in 1837 until 1976, the Baltimore Sun never employed more than two Black reporters at any given time. By 1979, the number had quadrupled to eight staffers out of a news team of 150. When the Sun assured that they would hire more Black reporters, they set out to hire Les Payne, an investigative journalist from Newsday. Payne was offered a position covering the federal courts with a salary of $3,000 less than what he was earning. Payne, a founder of the National Association of Black Journalists, declined the offer. In 1979, when the Sun did successfully recruit Black journalists, they often left quickly, averaging only a 3.5-year stint before moving on. Problems were not only seen in the newsroom, but on the pages of the Baltimore Sun as well. In 1984, Baltimore's chapter of the NAACP initiated what would become a 6-week boycott of the Sun for its coverage of Black people and the paucity of Black reporters. The NAACP took issue with the Sun's 5-part series on households headed by Black women, entitled Homes Without Fathers, arguing that the paper rested on old worn stereotypes and exhibited a pattern of, quote, contempt and disrespect toward Black Baltimore. The boycott was originally supposed to last 2 days, and it was named Sunless Sunday and Sunless Monday to remind boycotters to skip purchasing the paper. The group also picketed the Sun headquarters and called for supporters to refrain from buying from Sun advertisers. By the time the NAACP negotiated an agreement with the Baltimore Sun to hire more Black editorial staffers, to commit more energy to the coverage of African affairs, and adjust its tone and stories about Black Baltimore, the NAACP had successfully convinced 10,500 subscribers to cancel the paper.
The Baltimore Sun was a finalist in 2016 for a Pulitzer Prize for its Freddie Gray coverage. The nominated material included some decently thoughtful pieces on rough rides and lead paint poisoning, and one piece by Kevin Rector that did look at a few early discrepancies in the timeline. Without a doubt, the Baltimore Sun was the paper of record in the Freddie Gray case. It's cited more than any other source as an authority. While the Sun's editorial department was critical of BPD in this case, its crime reporting showed a bias towards accepting and promoting police narratives. This was obvious in stories like Justin George's series on the task force investigation, which portrayed the investigators not just uncritically, but as angels. Most major news outlets accepted BPD's timeline for the arrest, but the Sun took it a few steps further. They created interactive timelines and maps that laid out the six-stop narrative as if it were fact and proved the cops' innocence. There's only a tip of the hat to another view. One of the slides says, "Multiple witnesses tell the Sun they saw Gray beaten, but police say evidence including an autopsy disputes their accounts." That is not a sentence that ever came from police. That's how the Sun put it all together. When the Sun finally reported on Lieutenant Rice's troubled history, it gave almost as much space to a 1998 story about Rice rescuing a child from a burning house as it did to when he was hospitalized and his guns were confiscated because of a mental health breakdown 2 years before. The Sun wouldn't even call it a mental health breakdown. They soft-pedaled that. In response to court documents from Rice's ex, accusing Rice of harassment and threats, the Sun quoted the president of the Fraternal Order of Police. I would be very surprised if he did something like that. Well, okay, maybe he didn't then. The article also failed to credit the Associated Press and Guardian for breaking these stories. Similarly, Justin Fenton's story about the bolt theory was the only one I saw that didn't credit WJLA for the scoop. I've seen this often enough. I wonder if it is an editorial practice for the Sun to not admit that information is borrowed. I reached out to the Sun for comment about these issues with their Freddie Gray coverage. I'd hoped to speak with their reporters and editors and engage in a conversation about covering a case this huge. They declined to comment. This project definitely relied on the Baltimore Sun's coverage to learn the basics of the case, but for deeper analysis and diverse perspectives, we turned to a lot of independent and not just liberal media. Not all of the thoughtful analysis was happening on the left. A website called the Conservative Treehouse ran in-depth articles on the case. A writer called Sundance dug deep into the Dante Allen story, for example. He turned up the likely subject of Peter Herman's first article. That 38-year-old arrested on the same day, he may have had the same last name as Dante Allen. Sites like the Conservative Treehouse approach authority and media with as much skepticism as a liberal site like PNAC, but towards the opposite goal. It reminds me of that Saturday Night Live sketch, Black Jeopardy, where Tom Hanks's Trump-supporting character agrees with the black contestants about almost everything. Government surveillance, how to avoid a scam. They just don't agree on what lives matter.
We have found a significant imbalance between what actually happened in our cities and what the newspaper, radio, and television coverage of the riots told us happened. The commission, in studying last summer's disturbances, visited many of the cities and interviewed participants and observers. We found that the disorders, as serious as they were less destructive, less widespread, and less black-white confrontation than most people believed. These conclusions were made, not in 2015, but in 1967, by the Kerner Commission, assembled by President Lyndon Johnson to understand why tempers flared so often between the summer of 1964 through 1967. Little did he know that there were more spring and summers to come with unrest, often ignited by a moment of police brutality and fanned by media reports. Before we had the benefit of 24-hour news channels and a social media landscape where we can critique news coverage and representation in real time, the work of assessing how journalists helped or hurt communities in crisis was often left up to task forces and riot commissions. In addition to looking at what caused communities to explode in anger, how neighborhoods were treated by police, or suggestions on how to diversify local leadership, riot commissions often had more than a few words about how the news, its structures, its editors, and employees contributed to a climate of fear and hostility. In 1968, fewer than 5% of journalists and editors were people of color. According to Richard Prince of the diversity and news website Journalisms, in 2015, 13% of people working in media were people of color. Keep in mind, more than a third of the U.S. population is non-white. Recent findings from the American Society of News Editors Diversity Survey of more than 700 media outlets found that 17% of employees at print dailies and 23% of digital-only sites are journalists of color. The numbers for the Baltimore Sun have been reported in journalism studies as peaking at 19.6% in 1991, but falling to about 14% in the late 1990s. The journalism's website, the Maynard Institute for Journalism Education, and National Associations for Journalists of Color and LGBTQ journalists have all tried to close the gap between the industry and the stories they tell about marginalized and often silenced communities. The reporting in Baltimore, the fixation on a narrative of people of color and destruction, the lack of questioning official reports, and the dependence on leaks reflected the pervasive ways that race colors camera lenses, guides the reporter's pen, and shapes the newscaster's language. After months of interviewing people across the country about news coverage in the 1960s, the Kerner Commission found that most Black people had no confidence in what they called the white press. The report continued, "The average Black person couldn't give less of a damn about what the media say. The intelligent Black person is resentful at what he considers to be a totally false portrayal of what goes on in the ghetto. Most Black people see the newspapers as mouthpieces of the power structure." The report highlighted the ways that reporters relied heavily on police for information and served as mouthpieces for law enforcement rather than observers of what was actually happening, leading to, quote, "the impressions that police and press work together and toward the same ends." It's easy to assume that just because we have more news outlets than ever before, and because we can get on-the-ground reports like never before, the quality of our analysis and our thinking about race, policing, poverty, American cities is better. But that's not always the case. More information coming from the same perspectives doesn't make us better equipped to ensure that this time will be the last time. So nearly 50 years after the Kerner Commission report was released, their warnings to media and to all of us still ring frighteningly true. Lacking other sources of information, we formed our original impressions and beliefs from what we saw on television, heard on the radio, and read in newspapers and magazines. We are deeply concerned that millions of other Americans who must rely on the mass media, likewise, formed incorrect impressions and judgments about what went on in American cities. Kwame Rose, who was on our addendum episode 9, is the Baltimore activist who became known as the protester who confronted Fox News's Geraldo Rivera. Rose summed up what many Baltimore residents felt about Rivera and the other bands of roving reporters who failed to tell meaningful stories about what was unfolding.
Yeah, because you're not replying. We are angry. But listen, a Black man can raise his voice. A Black man can raise his voice, and you don't have to be intimidated. Because I want you and Fox News to get out of Baltimore City. Because you're not here reporting about the boarded up homes and the homeless people under immigration.
MLK. You're not reporting about the poverty levels up and down North Avenue.
Exactly.
2 years ago, when the 300 man marched and we marched from the top of Hoyland to from Hilton and North to Milton and North, you weren't here. But you're here for the black riots that happened. You're not here. You're not here for the death of Freddie Gray. You're here for the story. No, I want to talk to you without the cameras. Hey, take. This is not for YouTube. This is serious. I want the cameras off. I want the cameras off. I want the white media out of Baltimore City until y'all are here to report the real story.
Rose's plea for Rivera and other reporters to simply talk to him about the complexity of Baltimore was largely ignored, as television cameras continued to descend on the city, overestimating destruction and tensions, and underestimating the grief and the commitments to strengthening the city and remembering Freddie. I talked to Kwame about a few things that Rivera had no interest in talking to him about that day in April.
Part of my frustration that I voiced to the media during the protest was like, we should not be talking about why people are out here burning the CBS. We shouldn't be talking about why Freddie Gray ran away from the police or why Freddie Gray did. We should talk about the life Freddie Gray lived and how he never had a chance to begin with. Freddie Gray had lead paint poisoning, like 50% of the children in Baltimore City. We don't focus on that. Freddie Gray's parents were drug addicts, addicted to heroin, 70,000 heroin addicts in Baltimore City, a city with a population of only 600,000. Baltimore is the heroin capital of America, but we don't talk about that. We don't focus on the fact that Freddie Gray was living in an age group of 18, the number one unemployed age group of people in Baltimore City are black men from the ages of 18 to 24. So we don't talk about why he couldn't have a job, because had he had a job that adequately paid him, he might not have been outside. He might have been on his way to work. And so we don't talk about the life he lived and how the odds were stacked against him, and that one way or the other, it was going to be something that wasn't that killed him, whether it be lead paint poisoning, whether it be drug addiction, whether it be street violence, whether it be police brutality. And there are millions of Freddie Grays in this country. There are hundreds of thousands of Freddie Grays in Baltimore City. And we don't talk about the life that they live, that they lived, and the obstacles they faced. Instead, we just talk about how their life was taken and that one choice they made.
In April 2015, I was the editor-in-chief of a relatively popular women's website, which, contrary to unfair stereotypes of the genre, devoted the majority of our 20 or so daily blog posts to covering the news. For a couple weeks, that included the death of Freddie Gray and the uprising in Baltimore. It would be kind of shady of me to contribute to this episode on the media coverage of this case without acknowledging my own participation in that coverage. A drop in the well, though it may be. So I went back and read the posts again. I wrote a few, including a roundup of links to some great writing being done about what was going on in Baltimore. There are also two long-form pieces, a first-person dispatch from Baltimore and an op-ed, both written by a regular freelancer for the site. The rest were short posts aggregating information gathered by other news sources, both local and national. The day Mosby filed charges, I posted the video of her standing on the steps of City Hall. It was mostly just the facts in the video, but the point of view was definitely one that admired Mosby for charging not one, not two, but six officers. That one of the officers, Goodson, was charged with depraved heart murder clearly resonated because I copy-pasted the legal definition at the bottom of the post. Fitting, I wrote. While the website I ran didn't rank among the internet's top news sites, it was still at the mercy of the same fickle metric for success: clicks. But quantity does not equal quality, either in the work being produced or the people who are ingesting it. A surge in traffic equals a surge in filth that will need to be scrubbed from the comment section, let me tell you. Journalism has long been hindered by business constraints like spending cuts and production costs, but the internet-fueled 24-hour news cycle has actually turned journalism itself into a big business. The constraints remain, though, along with pressure to actually increase production. Banging out URLs was how the most recent CEO of the media company I worked for put it. This is something I discussed with Baltimore investigative reporter Jane Miller.
My concern about the internet and social media in particular is that it has created some really thin journalism. In fact, I wouldn't even call it journalism in many cases.
Mm-hmm.
Now, look, I'm old school, okay? That was the manual typewriters I started, all right? But I firmly believe this, and I lecture people on this that want to be journalists. There is no substitute for human sources,
right,
ever. I mean, all the reporting we're seeing coming out in the battle that's going on between the Post and the New York Times, which is fun to watch,
mm-hmm,
all of the reporting that's being attributed to unnamed sources in Washington related to the allegations of ties between Russia and the Trump campaign, that's not something that someone's going to find online. You're not going,
right,
to find that on a Twitter feed. You're not going to find that in a Facebook post. The information is coming from human sources.
Right.
And there's no substitute for developing a strong network of human sources. You know, I would say in the newsroom, there's no stories in the newsroom. You,
right,
may be able to find the data for a story that you need, but there's no substitute for human sources. That is true today. It was true during Watergate. It was true during every big story this country has ever seen. And my concern is that technology and online information, which is great because it does save you some time, but it can also make you lazy.
Right.
And the world does not need any more lazy journalists.
A common editorial strategy at many online content purveyors is to soak up every possible click by writing about every new piece of information related to a breaking news story, even if it hasn't been thoroughly vetted and no matter how repetitive most of the details will be. Albert Samaha did mostly original reporting for BuzzFeed about Freddie Gray, including a feature on the owner of the convenience store which provided the infamous Stop 3 footage. The angle is an important one. This newly discovered undisclosed stop begged for further investigation, and Samaha was among the first to score an interview with the store owner. His reporting was solid, especially when you consider that the article was published the same day as Stop 3 was disclosed. But as you might expect, this rush to publish leaves some questions not just unanswered, but unexplored entirely.
Did you wonder by any chance why there was only one piece of security footage released? I'm just curious if these are thoughts that other journalists have had when there's so many other security cameras along the route.
Mm-hmm. I guess it never really came to mind. I guess I always assume that the footage that the police are going to release are going to be, I always assume that, you know, the police aren't always going to tell are often not going to tell the full side of the story, and then it's our,
right,
job to kind of figure out the rest. I don't know. I never really thought about what the other security footage might have showed.
The push to dominate a news story, the way that the Baltimore Sun did with their Freddie Gray coverage, or even just to own a small slice like BuzzFeed, can blind the media to their own culpability in defining false narratives. Here's Samaha again.
I thought the coverage was good. There were a million reporters, converging in Baltimore at the time, and the challenge, and, me being one of those reporters as well, the challenge is trying to find where are the holes in the coverage that other people haven't yet filled. So anytime there's like a big breaking news event like that, there's so much competition to try to fill every hole that it just produces, while not every, piece of coverage will be good, there will be a lot of good coverage just because of the sheer mass of stories that are coming out of there. So I thought it was, I was satisfied with the coverage. I guess I was in a weird perspective because I was also covering it. So then, so my kind of understanding of the situation was probably a little more in depth than kind of the average reader just picking up a paper whose job it isn't, to follow it. But for the most part, I thought it was pretty strong and comprehensive those couple weeks after it happened.
I'm really not trying to pick on Samaha, by the way. This is just how the sausage gets made, and his is much better than a lot of what's out there. The most obvious example of the media inadvertently helping to push a false narrative is the whole rough ride theory. Casually mentioned by a few people close to the case, the likelihood that this would result in more people searching for the term rough ride on Google gave many online media outlets an opportunity to bang out a keyword-heavy URL or two in order to grab some extra clicks. Did it matter that there was literally no evidence that Freddie had been given a rough ride? It was a timely peg, the police commissioner had even mentioned it, and rough rides do happen. It's a worthy, important subject. But the saturation of these articles in just a couple of days still helped this become the prevailing narrative for Freddie's death. Anyway, most of the journalists we've interviewed were satisfied with the overall coverage of this case and continued to rely on local news outlets for the facts after the charges. And yet most also admitted that after 2 years and four trials, what happened to Freddie Gray remains a mystery. No one should be satisfied with that outcome. We certainly weren't.
The city of Baltimore was unsatisfied too. Unsatisfied with what they were being told about what happened to Freddie Gray, and unsatisfied knowing it was unlikely anyone would ever pay for his injury and death. And so, they took to the streets in what became known as the Baltimore Uprising. Next time on Undisclosed.
Listeners, don't forget we've got a live event coming this Thursday on June 8th. It's the same day as Adnan's big court hearing. If you're in town in Baltimore, we encourage you to come check it out. It's going to start at 6:30 p.m. and it's going to take place at Red Emma's Bookstore. That's at 30 West North Avenue. Again, that's 6:30 p.m. at Red Emma's. We hope to see you there. This week's episode of Undisclosed, episode 13, was co-produced in part by Justine Barron and Amelia McDonald Perry. Justine, Amelia, Dr. Marcia Chatlin, and Rabia Chaudhry co-wrote the episode, Methyl Telham produced, and Saad Chaudhry consulted. Our audio was produced by Rebecca Lavoie of Partners in Crime Media. Our great sponsors this week were Blue Apron, Bowl & Branch, and ThreadUp. As an independent podcast, sponsorship is necessary for us to make sure we can continue to produce Undisclosed for you and that you get it for free. Great sponsors make for great podcasts, so please check them out. Patrick Cortez and Ramiro Marquez composed Undisclosed theme music. Nina Mooser and Christy Williams design and maintain our website. That website is www.undisclosed-podcast.com, and Baluki does our graphics. You can find us on social media using our handle at UndisclosedPod. We're on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Don't forget to visit us on Thursdays at 6 p.m. for the Undisclosed Addendum featuring Dee Watkins for a discussion about this week's episode. Follow Dee on Twitter at DeeWatkinsWorld. Ask him questions about the episode with the hashtag Freddie Gray and or the hashtag UDAddendum. Lastly and leastly, Undisclosed's executive producer is Dennis Robinson, and he looks forward to Thursday, not only for the live episode, but also for a drop of the Undisclosed Addendum featuring Dee Watkins. Until then,